Good morning, everyone. On the takeaway this morning, we're going to dispense with the revelations for just a moment.
In the WikiLeaks releases. Yep.
It's really about, I mean, on some level, challenges. In that famous video about a year ago, WikiLeaks challenged the official account of a so-called
shooting.
Appropriate right. death of an enemy combatant when it released a bunch of low-level intelligence documents on Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
It challenged the value and the strategy and the tactics for taking low-level intelligence, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
In these diplomatic cables that were released over the weekend, it goes to the core of what diplomacy is all about and the need for secrecy in relations between countries. And to examine that challenge in the deepest way, we've invited Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, to be with us this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Morning, John.
Let's describe for a second the value as you see it to unguarded, unpublic, secret conversations of embassy staff and diplomats when they talk about world leaders or the people that they do business with in the course of their business with the State Department.
The biggest value is that secrecy provides a context for candor. It means that people can share their honest impressions. They can make recommendations, even if the recommendations might be controversial if they ever saw the light of day, if they somehow departed from existing policy. So that, to me, is the real advantage, that secrecy creates a situation where people can really give their unvarnished take on things and their most honest advice, regardless of how much China it might break.
But the secrecy isn't open-ended, it seems to me. Let's go back to 1982 when Paul Nitze took that famous walk in the woods with his Soviet counterpart. It was a private meeting. They hashed out an agreement which was eventually leaked. So it was actually as valuable that those two leaders were able to meet in private as it was for that information to be leaked out. Describe, first of all, why the walk in the woods is so important.
The walk in the woods or any real negotiation needs to often take place in private because the ambassadors or representatives of the two sides are trying to put together a deal. And almost always, individual pieces of the deal, if they were to be revealed, would be involve compromises that, if they were revealed, would put them in an untenable position. And often you need the entire package to be worked out and balanced before you can have it revealed in a way that people might look at it and say, okay, well, we give up A, B, and C. I don't like that. But we get E, F, and G. And because of that, I can live with it.
But Richard Haass, in that particular case, the irony was the leak was deliberate, presumably on the part of the U.S. side, as a way of signaling to the Europeans that on some level the U.S. was serious about arms control, and that was not the belief back in 1982 in the early months of the Reagan administration.
Fair enough. And people leak things for any number of reasons, including the management of public opinion in their country or others. But again, as you yourself pointed out, John, the leaking in this case was sequential. It didn't come out until Nitze and his Soviet counterpart at the time had put together a package that would not only reassure the Europeans, which was one purpose, but could survive scrutiny in the United States from the center and right.
All right. Well, then what's the value? Is it the secrecy or is it controlling the timing of the reveal of the leaks?
It could be any of the above. Again, it's not mutually exclusive. In other cases in the intelligence business, as you know, the secrecy is often to protect how you got the information as much as the information itself, so-called sources and methods. My own experience as a negotiator, though, premature leaks can make it impossible to get an agreement, that you often need the secrecy in private to put together a deal to allow your counterpart to sell it to his side, to prepare publics for the inevitable compromises. Things are not ready to see the light of day on day one. It's almost that simple.
All right, let's look at who maybe has lost cards in this WikiLeaks situation. Would you say that Benjamin Netanyahu, whose position on trading land for peace was ostensibly exposed by WikiLeaks, has lost a card to play with the Palestinians?
I don't think so. Netanyahu has made compromises before, and he, again, it's almost analogous to what you were talking about before in the case of Nitze. He's got multiple constituencies to assuage. He's got to reassure his own right that he's not giving away the farm. On the other hand, Netanyahu needs to appear as a peacemaker, at least someone willing to make compromises in the name of peace. So I don't think this creates real problems.
What about China, though? It seems like they've lost a card. If they ever try to say, hey, we can deliver the Pyongyang government on this or that, nobody's going to believe them.
Well, I'd put it somewhat differently. I think the Chinese have put themselves in an awkward or unattractive place. The fact that they allowed all sorts of shipments to go from North Korea to Iran, missile part shipments and so forth, it makes the Chinese look as someone who may talk the talk on nonproliferation, but they are clearly not doing what they could and should have. So it makes them look like something considerably less than a member of the club of great powers prepared to do the right thing.
You know, Richard Haass, I hear what you're saying about needing secrecy for some negotiations that are still in progress. But when I read some of these cables in which they call Angela Merkel of Germany risk-averse and rarely created, or they say Silvio Berlusconi of Italy was feckless and vain, that doesn't seem to me to be the kind of, that seems just like gossip. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would derail a negotiation.
You're exactly right. And there's big, you know, pieces of these things which are not secret. They don't do damage to real state interests. They might be slightly embarrassing or awkward or
reckless.
Or indiscreet, but you're right.
Let me give you an example that goes directly from what Celeste was saying. What if April Glaspie had known, the ambassador to Iraq, that her remarks would be in the New York Times the next morning when she suggested that the U.S. wouldn't respond if Iraq invaded Kuwait? Do you think she might have been more careful and said, hey, let me check on that, Saddam?
At the risk of correcting the record, that's not what she said. She simply said we would not take a position on the substance of your territorial claims. But she did remind Saddam that the United States had vital national interests in the area, which meant that the United States would defend them.
Do you think secrecy encourages at a low level diplomats to be maybe more reckless in their statements and that transparency is a good thing?
If it did, they're going to get over it real fast. I think some people learned some lessons that just because it's in a cable classified secret doesn't mean now in the Internet age it's going to stay that way. And transparency in many cases is fine. I think diplomats probably exaggerate how important secrecy is despite the thrust of our conversation. And at times, I think some of these cables will actually contribute to the public debate in a useful way about foreign policy and international relations.
I think it
lifts the veil.
I think, whatever happens to Julian Assange, I think you're absolutely right about that. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about the value of secrecy and the timing of leakage in diplomacy. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, John.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.